Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Long before the world had ever heard of COVID-19, concerns had been raised about big tech, big data, and how many aspects of our personal lives were being collected, collated, and used to create a profile that many of us might have misgivings about. Then, with the virus, schools and businesses shifted our lives more deeply into the online world as many of us started doing more things on the internet, giving big data collectors even greater access to our lives. When the recent protests here began, there were stories of some police departments surveying the crowds with drones and other technology. And the Attorney General reportedly gave DEA agents new authority to conduct covert surveillance on protesters. Is this just a blip in time or another step in our ongoing loss of privacy? How concerned should we be about all of this? Is this yet another new normal? To talk about that, we have invited two uniquely qualified individuals to spend this hour with us. Dr. Zach Rogers is a research fellow at the Jeff Bleich Center for the U.S. Alliance in Digital Technology, Security, and Governance in Adelaide, Australia, at Flinders University. The center was established to address the misuses of digital technologies that undermine public trust and effective democratic governance. I must tell you, Dr. Rogers, you are our first guest from Australia. Welcome to the program. Welcome to the country.
That's fantastic, Mike. Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be invited on. Appreciate it.
I should point out that when we're done here this hour, it will be 30 minutes before tomorrow in your part of the world.
So, understood.
Okay. Albert Foxconn is also here. He is the founder and executive director of STOP, the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project at the Urban Justice Center, and a fellow at NYU School of Law's Engelberg Center on Innovation, Law, and Policy. He's also an attorney, technologist, and writer who founded STOP on the belief that emerging surveillance technologies pose an unprecedented threat to civil rights and the promise of a free society. And I'm presuming that you're joining us from someplace in New York. Welcome.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
You're welcome. Zach, let me begin with you. Before we talk about surveillance and individual digital footprints and how they're being used and what's going on, tell me why there is a U.S. Center, or a Center for the U.S. Alliance in Digital Technology, Security, and Governance in Adelaide, Australia.
That's a great question, Mike. Thank you for that. We recognize, Mike, that there's a gap when we're talking about, let's say, cybersecurity, such a big, broad topic as cybersecurity. What we've been, our research center and what our research before JBC was established was moving into, was trying to understand some of the broader social and political implications that have emerged from our long-standing but more increasingly rapid uptake of digital technologies across society and across the political economy. And we were just recognizing increasingly that there was a big gap between what cybersecurity is generally about and what technologists discuss when they're discussing cybersecurity and the broader implications of the digital age, if you like. So Our American Studies department at Flinders University had an existing relationship with Ambassador Bleich, who was the ambassador to Australia under Obama. And that relationship was something that was already established. So there was just an opportunity to put together what we thought was a really timely and really important center to have a take a look at these issues, and that's really the genesis of the Jeff Bleich Center. And we've been established for about a year now, and yeah, things are growing, and it's certainly a very timely time to look into these issues. And we think there is a unique place for some of these to expand out cybersecurity into what we call social cybersecurity. And we study also digital anthropology in the context of democratic resilience.
Is there any significance to the fact that it's you're studying US and Asia and not European technology?
Yeah, well, the again, the context of our partnership is under the US-Australia Alliance. So that is a very much a central part of the Jeff Bleich Center. But I mean, technology is global. I guess there's not really, I mean, there is some interesting questions about different regions and the technologies that are being developed and deployed there. But when we talk about digital technology, as I'm sure Albert would attest, we are talking about something that's global. But when we talk about supply chains, and now there is a fracturing, not only of the internet, but there's a big fracturing going on those in that digital supply chain, all the way from, you know, internet cables to the semiconductor supply chains. And our part of the world's a really interesting, plays an interesting role in that. I'm talking about sort of East Asia, where all the big foundries for semiconductors are located. So there's kind of a new geopolitics of digital and a new geopolitics of information that we focus a lot of our research on as well.
And go ahead, Albert.
Well, I completely agree this is a global issue. And one of the most high profile examples, especially as you look at supply chain diversity, is 5G and how there's been a huge fight in a variety of countries in the US and Europe about what role Chinese firms can play in manufacturing the backbone of the next segment of our internet, you know, 5G wireless technology. And so this is something that, even though we're talking about global technologies, it becomes a highly nationalistic endeavor in a lot of cases.
And we're concerned about China's participation in helping us to develop 5G technology because we don't trust them. Is that the gist of that?
Exactly. There's a lot of concern that if Chinese firms, especially those with a relationship with the Chinese military and Chinese state, are playing a role in developing the backbone of our internet, that will give them a lot of power to potentially undermine encryption and security.
Then why do we trust Lenovo computers, which are built in China? Why do we allow certain telephones to be manufactured in China? I don't believe that we in the United States allow them in, but people in Europe do. So why?
That's a very, very interesting geopolitical question, Mike. What we are looking at is the global supply chains in all things digital were globalized some time ago. And that model is really breaking down. I think not only is the internet is splintering into what Scott Malcolmson described as a splinter net, but indeed the very supply chains, as I said, all the way from the entire digital stack really, Mike. So all the way from the submarine cable, you know, who manufactures and lays those cables, the very bedrock of the internet, all the way up through regional digital architectures, all the way down to your local tower network, and all the way up to that human computer interface. So who's manufacturing the phones? And indeed, as Albert mentioned, the 5G networks and all of that technology, and indeed all the way up to the algorithms that are manipulating human behavior right at the top of that digital stack. The entire stack, if you like, is now a contested zone, if you like, geopolitically. So why do some companies still a part of the stack in some countries? Well, those are very, very interesting questions, Mike. And I think we're watching the splintering of that, but we're also discovering how difficult it is to disentangle yourself as a country or even as a region from these supply chains. So it's an incredibly fluid and interesting place to be studying right now.
Albert, your area of expertise is a little different from Zach Rogers' area in that I think you founded the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project to deal with things that are more hardware-oriented and procedure, process-oriented in terms of how authority figures are using this technology. When did you start this project and why?
Yeah, so I started STOP last year because I saw that while we've had this debate about surveillance at the federal level for, you know, decades since 9/11, you know, and something that was really fueled by, you know, the disclosures from Edward Snowden, that we haven't talked as much about the way that local police departments are using some of these same invasive surveillance technologies to monitor communities of color, to over-police the same communities that have been targeted time and time and time again for centuries. And that, you know, systems like facial recognition, drones, predictive policing, social media analytics, the use of artificial intelligence, these were all perpetuating a surveillance state that felt much more like 1984 than 2020. And
that's not hyperbole in your mind, right?
I think we honestly have a level of state data collection in the United States that goes far beyond what George Orwell would have even imagined when he wrote the book. I think that we see, you know, for example, with our recent protests, these amazing protests where thousands of people are taking to the street at once, and they don't know that simply having a cell phone on them could give the government a way to track that they were there, that simply having their face visible could give the government a way to track that they were there through facial recognition, that there are all these ways that our bodies and our electronic devices are being turned into perpetual tracking beacons. And in a lot of large cities, that also means that this information is being stored in massive databases that can include tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of individuals who haven't done anything wrong, but simply have been photographed, quote, in the wrong place at the wrong time.
We're going to talk about that at some depth as we go through this program. Zach, you wrote a recent article in which you reference something called the control revolution, which I had never heard of until I read your article. That it began in the 1980s, and it's now arrived at the point, you say, where big data and predictive technologies have been turned into the goal of automating human behavior. This is a little different concern than what Zach has. What you're saying is that we're being manipulated. Is this being used mainly to mine our online activities, to direct us to places that algorithms think we want to go, essentially guiding, using, they're being used as guided sales devices? Is that what this, you're talking about here?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Mike. So, you know, the way I call it, the model I describe it as is the gather, analyze, predict, and manipulate data model. So that's essentially the dominant internet business model. And that is basically how all the big tech platforms make their money. But they do that by selling us advertising. You're exactly right. So all the data is gathered, it's analyzed. Patterns in human behavior are discovered in that data corpus. And then the data can be anonymized, so it can be de-identified technically, but all of these behavioral categories are then available to essentially whenever a web page is loading, an invisible audit is taking place where those behavioral categories are being sort of are bidding in an auction for whatever client has bought that advertising space. And a sort of a matching process is taking place at light speed whenever pages are loading. And that's essentially how these systems now work. So you and I might be in a behavioral category that says we're 80% likely to do a certain thing. And what the algorithm's able to do then is direct us through direct us information, whether it's advertising or just through directing us through information transiting that network, able to push me to maybe 85% likely to do something or 90%. Now, that might just be buying a certain pair of shoes or changing a brand of dog food or whatever, but these are behavioral manipulations. And what the concern really is that that's creating, with that 20% behavior that I was may not have done is being shrunk down and diminished. So my optionality, the alternative behaviors are being diminished.
So we'll look at that and what that means, because as a consumer, I might like this, but maybe I shouldn't. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Zach Rogers joins us from Australia, the Jeff Bleich Center for the U.S. Alliance in Digital Tech Security, Technology, Security, and Governance at Flinders University, where he is a research fellow. Albert Fox Kahn is the founder and executive director of a Surveillance Technology Oversight Project at the Urban Justice Center. I wanted to get back to something you were talking about, Zach, just before the break. We all benefit in some ways, I suppose, by how these algorithms work when we're online shopping for something. What you're saying is that they have been able, through the manipulation of these algorithms and letting these algorithms learn from our behavior, to nudge us a little more toward what they would like us to do. And you say that makes us more fragile. Does it also make us less knowledgeable and certainly more easily manipulated, unbeknownst to ourselves?
I think that's very true, Mike. That you know, part of that 20% of behavior that is diminishing because we're being nudged, shifted, you know, steered towards 85-90% to do a certain thing. That might seem a bit benign to some people, Mike, but it's really important because that 20% of behavior is our optionality. It's where we learn. It's where we discover. It's where our creativity is. And indeed, you use the word fragility. It's really where the robustness of human systems operate in that 20% of alternative behavior. So as we've allowed this dominant business model to take over the internet, where nudging human beings into certain behaviors has become really dominant. It does raise questions about how it affects cognitive learning, and it affects a lot of things about attention and all the other things that spill over from allowing ourselves to be constantly manipulated by algorithms.
Albert.
So I think it's really crucial to highlight the way these algorithms undermine our free will, that they deprive us of meaningful choice. But we also have to acknowledge that these aren't neutral. These systems are often biased against communities of color, against women. Look at, for example, at Apple's high profile credit card launch, where their credit scoring artificial intelligence was taking applications from women who had the exact same income, the exact same assets, and was giving them a lower credit score and giving them a lower credit line. And we see the same bias feedback loop playing out in policing, where a lot of the artificial intelligence systems that are trying to predict who is going to commit a crime are learning from past biased policing and perpetuating the same cycle of injustice just through automation.
There's another aspect to this that I guess we should talk about, because we're in the middle of this COVID-19 pandemic. And I guess that raises some privacy concerns, because there have been attempts to track the virus, and you can't track the virus without tracking us. And they're doing that with cell phones in various different ways. Governments at all levels are considering using, or have considered, and in some cases do use, mass surveillance to track us on our cell phones to see where we've been, who we've come in contact with in some countries, and there are ramifications to that. It sounds benign, but you say that the surveillance risks here, Albert, are more dangerous than the rewards. How so?
Well, having broad-based electronic contact tracing, such as the Bluetooth tracing design that Apple and Google have put forward, it's dangerous, not just to civil rights, but it actually is a threat to public health, because these systems are going to distract from the evidence-based model that works, which is having culturally competent manual contact tracing. This is the new high-tech version of hydroxychloroquine. This is a magic pill that won't actually cure anything. And when we look at how the tech has worked abroad, it really hasn't helped fight the disease, because, for example, in Singapore, you had only a tiny fraction of the community agreeing to use this app. And as a result, they now have one of the highest rates of COVID-19 infection anywhere in the globe. But we also have to look at the fact that, you know, there are no safeguards in U.S. law to stop employers from forcing their employees to use these invasive apps. There's no safeguards to prevent, you know, schools from forcing children to use these apps. And there are no safeguards to prevent law enforcement or even ICE from coming in and using this data from our own health data to arrest and even deport Americans.
If they put controls on it, and I know that the law always lags technology, sometimes by decades, but if they put controls on it, would you feel more comfortable? Given the urgency of getting a handle on COVID-19, would you feel more comfortable with it?
Oh my gosh. Here in New York, in the epicenter of this crisis, we know this is a matter of life and death. We know that we have to do anything that works to fight COVID-19. But having privacy protection on these Silicon Valley solutions isn't actually going to make them work. I feel like COVID-19 tracking apps are like having a house on fire. And when you put a privacy safeguards around it, you're just walling off the house. It's still on fire, but you're not actually doing anything to solve the problem.
Zach,
And
why don't you go ahead? I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
I was just going to say that, really what we need is to just own up to the massive national investment we need in hiring Americans, so many of whom are unemployed, to do manual contact tracing.
Zach, you're nodding in agreement to much of that.
Yeah, indeed, Mike. I mean, in Australia, we've been both a lot luckier than a lot of other places, but we've also, I think, the government deserves credit in terms of, and the population deserves credit in terms of the way they've responded to some of the challenge of the COVID-19 pandemic. But I'll just speak to a couple of things that Albert raised, and I am in agreement that for me, I think of it on two levels. When the government here started discussing and talking about and trying to get people to take up the contact tracing app. On one level, we have a question about very, very sort of practical questions. Where's the data stored? Who has access to that building? Who has access to that data? And there were some very legitimate queries in the Australian community about those very tactical level implications. But I think Albert touched on as well more broadly. The concern for me is that is to use a military term, what is the mission creep that could occur here, where these technologies could be implemented for one set of reasons, and then they just slide and creep over time into another set of reasons and another set of rationalizations. But even more broader than that, I worry about the normalization and socialization of total surveillance. And that's been going on for quite a long time, well before this particular crisis. And that part of the discourse is not being properly addressed by almost any community in the world. So that's what I try to get people to think more broadly about these digital privacy questions.
You write, Albert, that social media check-ins, where users post their location to Facebook and other platforms, now are a tool for monitoring transmission, I guess, of COVID-19. Suddenly, what movies you watch, where you travel, how you communicate to work, or commute to work, rather, where you go to eat, from being consumer data, it's now become a metric of your COVID-19 exposure. And as Zach just pointed out, you worry that once this is over, once we've moved beyond COVID-19, that the technologies they develop here that are successful here will be adapted to other things and we won't even know it. Is that where you're coming from?
Yeah, I mean, in the aftermath of 9/11, we enacted emergency legislation that was supposed to expire in 2005, but that was extended and extended and extended again. And now there are people who are trying to extend these same emergency temporary, in quotes, measures until 2024. So we have to expect that whatever surveillance powers we grant the state to deal with COVID-19 are going to become a permanent facet of our lives. And I completely agree that this is a chilling expansion of government authority. Already in China, we see the government there trying to expand and make permanent the COVID-19 tracking infrastructure that is there. And with this tool, we really are giving even more control to government at a time when we are rightfully scared of how this particular administration and its law enforcement agencies will use and weaponize that information.
I suppose they could pass laws preventing that from happening if people follow the law once it's passed, because these are things that are so shady and beyond the realm of most people's cognition that it would be difficult to determine whether the law is being followed. But the other aspect of this is that we could stop voluntarily giving up our information, couldn't we?
As long as it's truly voluntary, but what happens when you get told that you're going to lose your paycheck, you're going to lose your job if you don't have this app on your phone because your employer wants to advertise that they're using this technology. Right now, we don't have employee protections. We don't have student protections. Having privacy laws is important, but we need so many additional protections. But I want to also just highlight, the last high profile example of Silicon Valley trying to solve a health issue was Theranos, the boondoggle company that, got millions, if not billions, in venture capital for an idea that turned out to be a complete fraud. People are talking big talk about what these apps will do, but they don't have the science to actually back up their claims. And it really, if you look at what public health officials are begging for, asking for, pleading for, it's manual contact tracing and the individuals that we need to do community interviews.
The Trump administration floated the idea of partnering with Google to create this screening triage website, for lack of a better term, to help determine which individuals might be prioritized for COVID-19 treatment. Has that happened, or is that an idea that's fallen by the wayside?
Like all Trump administration claims, it had a tenuous relationship to the truth, even from the beginning. So what Google had done was one of its subsidiary companies had partnered with Bay Area officials to do a local website in California to help people there understand if they could get tested for COVID-19. That was operational. But when you look at the terms and service of that site, it says it's not governed by HIPAA, our national health privacy law, that it's not even governed by that bare minimum level of protection. And certainly there's nothing to stop police or ICE or the IRS from coming in and using the information entered into that website. And so we think that, there are millions of Americans who won't participate in these public health efforts if they have to second guess how this information might be used against them in a court of law.
Mm-hmm. These apps that track you and tell the government where you've been so that they can do contact tracing are in use, I believe, in China. In Hawaii, they rolled out something called the Safe Travels System. I'm not sure how that works, but it gives officials information on how travelers comply with the state's 14-day quarantine requirement as people arrive in the state from elsewhere. It was pretty tough, I'm told, on those who didn't want to cooperate. But you say that while this is practical, it isn't legal. So if it isn't legal, why isn't it legal? And why are they using it if it isn't legal?
I mean, look at the last time we had an economic catastrophe on this scale. It was the Great Depression. And you had states in the U.S. trying to erect borders, trying to say, if you want to come to California from the Dust Bowl, you can't. They would literally try to set up roadblocks and set up all of these vagrancy laws. And our Supreme Court said, you can't block Americans from coming to your state, that we are a single union, that we sink or swim together. And what Hawaii is doing is trying to create a border from the rest of the United States and throwing people in jail for violating quarantine orders, and at a time when we know that prison is one of the most dangerous places to be if you have a risk of COVID-19.
Zach, when the internet came to be and when we started to get smartphones, many of us saw this as a wonderful tool to make ourselves smarter, to make life more convenient, easier, etc. And we never knew that the information that we were, the little digital tracks we were leaving behind, these breadcrumbs, so to speak, were going to come back to bite us. And in many cases, people say, well, I've got nothing to hide. I buy things from Etsy or I buy things from Amazon. And so what if you know that I bought a toaster oven from Amazon? Who cares? Should we care?
Yeah, I really think we should, Mike. That's a very, very common attitude that still is very prominent among the populations. And a lot of our work is aimed at sort of expanding that and digging down a bit deeper. Sure, one way you could look at it is that you're just being nudged towards the things you were going to buy anyway, or the behaviors you were going to adopt anyway. And you might not, some people, I think that's a bit creepy and I think that's a bit suboptimal, but some people might not be as creeped out by it as others. But the deeper question here, Mike, is that we're being socialized into a system where the digital data that's rendered from our behavior is being treated as if that is who we are and that's what we are. So your digital ectype, the digital version of you, is not really you. It's a digital version of you, and it's not, it shouldn't be conflated with who you are. But as we, this is why I referenced the control revolution in that article. And there's a much longer story here, Mike, to tell about how economists have changed their attitudes towards information and knowledge, how the integrity of the self, if you like, has really shifted over the decades, and that this idea that I am my data or that I am my behavior is really an idea links back to some very controversial ideas in psychology around behaviorism that was debated heavily quite a lot around the middle of last century. A lot of ideas about behaviorism have taken on a pretty negative connotation, but we're kind of back there, and we're back there because this explosion of data really encouraged people to take up that positivist behaviorist orientation towards human beings, which kind of, it makes us really externalized, and it diminishes some of those internal things that are might not be measurable, might not be as quantifiable as data, but they've always been important parts about the way human beings think about themselves and think about meaning and purpose in life. So that really externalization in this world of big data is a much bigger philosophical concern with social and political implications that our debates just don't get to enough.
I mean, I think it's one thing to have our behavior as we buy things quantified so that maybe if you bought this, maybe you'd like to buy that. That's one thing. But now we're moving education online because of the pandemic, and maybe that's likely to stay there for a good part of certain classes. We're moving office work online, and that's giving people a whole new view into who we are and what we do and how we do it. I have about 30 seconds here. Do you see this as a big problem going forward? Collecting this kind of data.
Yes, I do, Mike. Yeah, the expansion through the digitalization of everything from COVID, just it increases that human behavior that goes into a probability equation and then gets predicted and manipulated. So we need to try and stay out of those spaces.
And when we come back, I want to talk some more about how this data is being used and how it can be used to manipulate us in other areas, such as elections, and how it may be how surveillance is being used during this riot. I'm Mike Collins. Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about various forms of surveillance and the increasing use of technology and digital footprints and more, as we'll talk about in this next segment, to trace our activities. Albert Fox Kahn is founder and executive director of STOP, the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project at the Urban Justice Center, and a fellow at NYU School of Law's Engelberg Center on Innovation Law and Policy. He joins us from New York. Zach Rogers is with us from Australia. He's a research fellow at the Jeff Bleich Center for the U.S. Alliance on Digital Technology, Security, and Governance in Adelaide, Australia. The data that is being collected through our use of the internet and smartphones, etc. You say these, Zach, that these systems are designed to manipulate us for market-driven purposes, and they now threaten to morph into nothing less than the manipulation of humans by machines. And that the research discipline spawned by these enormous collections of data have, quote, yielded staggering insights into human cognition and behavior with potential uses that are far from benign. And you are talking here now, I believe, about election interference, about fake news through information warfare and online extremism. We have already experienced this in this country. And what makes this different from influence campaigns prior to social media is that we are participating in the process by voluntarily giving up information on ourselves, including what we click on and where we go and that thing we carry in our pocket called a smartphone. So do you think that after all the news that has come out about this and the examples we've had of fake news and manipulation of people in their voting preferences, that people understand that this is happening right now?
I think increasingly, Mike, people are coming to that understanding, but there's a hell of a lot of more work to do. But we have sort of a two-track problem where our information environment is being manipulated. That is true. And some of those manipulations are, yes, foreign actors and malign actors. But also, as we've been talking about, the information environment is fundamentally an exploitative and deceptive environment. We are being manipulated by algorithms to do benign things like buy things, but also potentially to do malign things like interfere in elections and so forth. So it's really the fracturing and arguably the disutility of the information environment that we have to address really as collectively when we think about the digital age and we think about cybersecurity more broadly. We have to somehow get a foothold back in this information environment because it is pretty much a jungle now, and it's only going to get worse.
You know, we've been manipulated through advertising for most of the 20th century because that's when advertising really exploded with the advent of radio and television, and of course through newspapers. But you call that passive manipulation, and you see the consumption of information through, I guess, less traditional sources, active. What's the difference? Why?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mike. So when those traditional media sources we talk about, so whether it's radio, newspaper, magazine, television, the consumer of that information is certainly subject to propaganda and to information manipulation, but the consumer remains sort of metaphorically at an arm's length from that information. You know you are consuming that information on the television, the radio, the newspaper, and you do sit back from it and you do at least have the capacity to shift your orientation to that information you're consuming. But when it comes to participatory platforms, essentially where that arm's length is reduced to nothing. So when I'm an actor in my own propaganda, effectively, when I'm posting, commenting, sharing, when I'm literally an actor in that narrative, I think that space is reduced. And that's why the power of manipulation in what we call participatory propaganda is vastly increased over those more traditional forms.
I need to move on to Albert and talk about these demonstrations that we've been experiencing, but I do want to clear something. I want to probe a little deeper on that because it's not just advertising or product buying that we're being manipulated into doing. And it's this fake news and the fact that I'm a little confused about something. Even if you don't like the New York Times or the Washington Post or CBS News, these are organizations that have been around a long time. And they vet the information that goes through their channels to the best of their ability. Whether or not you believe it's slanted, it is vetted. The information that you're getting from some no-name website or through some social media channel that you don't know has not been vetted. So why do people trust that more than they trust traditional media now? Why? Albert, go ahead.
It's a great question.
Well, I think there's a John Adams quote on point. You're entitled to your own opinion, but now your own facts. And the problem is that this technology has given us the ability to find our personal echo chamber where we hear our own voice repeated back to us. And the algorithms are optimized to feed us what we click on, what we're engaged in, what we think is most interesting. And all too often, that means hearing what we already agree with, because very few of us actively choose to engage with opinions that we dislike. You know, if we hear about, you know, a bad story for a candidate we support, we're less likely to click on that link than if it's a bad story about a candidate we oppose. And with social media, because of the power of these platforms, in extreme cases, that's even led to ethnic cleansing, as we saw in Myanmar with Rohingya refugees and an entire ethnic community being targeted because of hate speech on social media platforms.
So is that, in a nutshell, the impact of active participation then, Zach?
Um,
because you're participating in something, you're hearing your ideas confirmed because you're only talking to people who think like you, and therefore it makes it more appealing to you. And that's active participation versus getting it from an outside third party source. That's just telling
you stuff. Exactly right, Mike. Yeah, that's exactly what we mean. And just to add to Albert's point, we sort of characterize this, the shift in the information environment as from vertical information flows, where we would traditionally take our information through these institutions, be they the New York Times or whatever television channel. That's essentially horizontalized. So now we can all reach out because of the internet and connectivity. We can all reach out at arm's length and connect to any form of information, and we're forming our knowledge in that plane, if you like. So the collapse of vertical institutional information flows into vast horizontal information flows has shifts our institutional intentionality. So effectively, it's changing my relationship to the very concept of truth. If I don't need to go up a vertical hierarchy to get to it, then my intentionality is that I can get it anywhere. And this is how, this is augmenting what Albert's saying about the development of these echo chambers and these opinion bubbles. It's actually a shift in the flow of information as well, Mike.
So let's move back into the surveillance aspect of this and into the hardware aspect of this, because it's not all algorithms and computer stuff, wizardry. It is the ubiquity of things like cameras. Suddenly, they are everywhere, and we don't even realize that they are everywhere, on street corners, on lampposts, at traffic lights, on freeways, inside and outside private businesses, inside and outside private homes, in public buildings. Most of us are on TV all the time, and we don't even know it. Have these cameras been used for illicit or illegal purposes? Have they resulted in harm to ordinary law-abiding citizens? Or do they function in the way we are told they were intended to function, Albert?
Well, because a lot of these camera systems are being used with facial recognition, a lot of times that footage is being fed into a database and they're going through and they're trying to come up with a match. But the problem is that commercial facial recognition software, a lot of the tools police are using, they're biased. They get it wrong much more often for women of color in particular, but all people of color and for trans individuals. And so that means that you're at a higher risk of being falsely stopped, falsely arrested, or even a victim of police violence because of your image getting captured and then facial recognition getting it wrong, which is why groups all across the country, including in North Carolina, are calling for bans on facial recognition. Because as we've seen so painfully with the death of George Floyd, that a simple police interaction can be a matter of life and death.
How are these cameras being used by law enforcement during these protests? I know you're in New York City, so perhaps you have better knowledge of what's happening there, but how are they being used?
Well, part of the problem is we won't have a full answer for years, because in many states and cities, police departments can use this technology first and ask for permission later. Mm-hmm. So we know that in New York, they have tens of thousands of cameras, and this includes CCTV camera, body-worn cameras. It includes drone footage, low-flying aircraft. It includes partnerships with area businesses where they're able to get private camera feeds in real time into this sort of surveillance nerve center. And all of that is then feeding into these giant databases, into the facial recognition, and into other tracking tools.
There have been a number of TV shows, and you have to take TV shows, drama shows, with a grain of salt, but they have used these principles. And I always thought, well, that's like science fiction. Maybe they'll be able to do that someday, but certainly not now. You're saying that they're doing it right now.
They're doing it, but without actually using scientific methods, right? So let me give you an example. In one case, they had an image of a black man and they wanted to do facial recognition search on him, but only part of his face was visible. So they went on to Google Images, searched for, quote, black male model, found a random man's face, copied that person's jawline onto this other image, and then ran this collage through facial recognition. And because of that, a person got a visit by the NYPD. It's pseudoscience, and it's dangerous pseudoscience at that. But because of the millions and millions of unaccountable dollars that have flown into this, the police departments have expanded this technology without actually showing that it is accurate, or let alone non-biased.
And there are other forms of surveillance. I know Attorney General William Barr has given the Drug Enforcement Administration new authority to conduct covert surveillance and to collect information on people participating in these protests, I guess particularly around the White House. Has there been any impact of that yet? And do we know of local police departments doing anything similar? And hasn't this always been part and parcel of public safety? Haven't they always infiltrated things before just to see who the leaders are and what they're thinking?
But it's unconstitutional to target people simply for lawfully protesting, as is often happening. But we have high-tech tools like millimeter wave detection systems, which can see through building walls or through a car or underneath people's clothes. It includes thermal imaging. It includes going after people's social media, scraping that data to see who is saying negative comments about police. Here in New York, we have a multi-million dollar campaign to do sentiment heat mapping, creating a color-coded map of what we think about the police, spending millions of dollars to track block by block what the public sentiment is, rather than just listening to the cries of protesters on the street. But we're fighting for a bill here in New York called the Public Oversight of Surveillance Technology Act, or POST Act, that we expect will pass in the next week. And similar bills around the country are passing that would require police to tell the public how they are spying on us.
I have about 2.5 minutes left, and I don't want to end this program without talking about something that most people are completely unaware of and that you alluded to earlier, and that is the ability to sweep up vast amounts of information by people in these large crowds simply by going after their cell phones. It's a geofence warrants is a term that people have not heard of before, I would think, most of them. How do they do this, and is that legal? Can you just get a warrant to take information from everybody's cell phone in a crowd of 1,000 people?
I think it is blatantly unconstitutional. At the founding of this country, we said warrants need to be specific because we saw the British authorities use general warrants that let them go into anyone's house, anyone's business, anyone's papers. And this is the digital equivalent. Police can literally go onto Google Maps, draw a circle around a specific building, and say, give me the information for everyone who is there. And that can be tens of people. It can be hundreds of people. In some cases, it's thousands. In one bank robbery in Northern Virginia, they drew the circle so large that they included the entire congregation of a nearby church, demanding all of their information in order to investigate this one robbery. We don't believe that is proper in a democratic society. A warrant should be a way to check police power. It shouldn't be a free pass to spy on anyone in a specific neighborhood. And especially during these protests, we're deeply fearful of how this tool could be used to spy on protesters, which is why we're working to outlaw the practice.
So all of this is incredibly complex, everything we've talked about, and much of it's proceeding much faster than law-abiding citizens or government people can keep up with. Are we like the frog, Zach, in a boiling pot of water here, where the brakes are being put on successfully? Can we put the brakes on successfully, Zach? Very quickly.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like that, Mike. And that is because the people talk about technological revolutions of the past, and they've been disruptive, but we've eventually moved past them. What I would say about this one is that it is unprecedented in scale and speed.
Dr. Zach Rogers is a research fellow at the Jeff Bleich Center for the U.S. Alliance in Digital Technology, Security and Governance in Australia. And Albert Fox Kahn is the founder and executive director of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project at the Urban Justice Center. Thank you both. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.